The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So I'm going to be talking about what is a disability. And this talk was inspired by another monk when we were traveling to Reading for medical appointments. And she asked me for advice on training with disabilities or infirmities. I'm not quite sure which word she used. And I was kind of taken aback because at that moment I wasn't thinking that I had any disabilities. I had I've had a bad back since 1980, and that has affected my life definitely. And I have myriad digestive problems with a fairly restricted diet, and that certainly has affected things. And the reason I was going down there had to do with my foot, which I've been having a lot of trouble with since January, and I'm having surgery actually at the end of the month. So, but at that moment, these were just things I was training with, and I didn't see them as disabilities. So I think whether something is a disability or not is really in the mind, and how we look at it, and how we train with it. But I haven't always felt this way. Sometimes I get disturbed, and they get me down. But I do eventually bounce back, which I think is kind of a normal thing. And when we see it as something as a disability, no matter what it is, we can become so focused on it that that is our main focus. And we might be angry or depressed or whatever. Disabilities and illness can also bring up the reminder of our own vulnerability, impermanence, that we're not in control. Been reading a couple books, a couple of articles in Buddha Dharma magazine, and one of them was called When Illness Is Our Path. And I'm not going to read that much of this article, but he describes how we can get when we get ill. We all suffer from illness from time to time, and usually when that happens, our practice goes out the window. The illness becomes compelling and we forget about whatever else we were trying to do. We are completely occupied with the illness, which we don't like, so we become crabby and sometimes fearful. Or we might try to ignore the illness and soldier on. But even if this is possible, there seems to be a dulling or a dragging effect on our mood, though we may be successful in covering this up in public. Either way, the illness takes us over, and we are just waiting for it to go away, or fearing that it won't go away, or maybe knowing it isn't going to go away. So that's one way we can react to illness and disability. I wanted to give an example from my own experience. I think it was in 1992, my dog had some fleas, and we were having fleas in the monastery during that time. And I flea-bombed my room. And right after that, I developed chemical sensitivities. And I don't know if all of you know what that is, but it can be really awful. And it was quite bad at first where, well, I won't go into the gory details, but you react to basically everything in your environment. And so you can't be... It's difficult to be around other people, you know, to be in a room that is affecting you. Like the walls are becoming liquid and you're feeling them in your body. It's pretty weird. And so it was a very difficult time for me. I felt very isolated and different from everyone else in the monastery. I had to rebuild the inside of my room completely with special products so I could live in it. I talked with a number of people who had chemical sensitivities because I had to get their advice on various things, and this scared me. You know, just talking to these people, oh, it's just going to get worse. You're going to have to just isolate yourself completely and do this and that. And I became really scared. And but fortunately, there was a former monk, Rowena, who had severe chemical sensitivities, and she'd had them for a very long time, and she was very sensible about it. And this kind of brought me back to a more sane approach to the whole thing, which I'm very grateful for. But it was a very dark, despairing, scary time for me, and I was completely drawn into it. Monks seemed unsympathetic and annoyed, probably with good reason. And I have to say, Reverend Echo got me through this because he gave me a very hard time, and it was giving me that hard time continuously that brought me back. So I'm very grateful for it. At one point, I thought I would have to go live somewhere else because I, you know, there wasn't any room that worked perfectly for me. And I went out to this house that Rowena had built for herself. She was always building new houses. And then when she had problems with that house, she had, fortunately had some money. She would go to another house and try another thing. And I think, I can't remember exactly, but I think Echo said to me, well, you know, if you go move there, you're essentially leaving. You know, you're giving up being a monk. And he may not have said that exactly, but I remember coming back from that, and what came up really strongly was I'd rather tie on my meditation seat than leave the monastery. So I have to say that something is working with us, no matter, you know, how far we go off. But it was very interesting because one evening, I was always doing my walking meditation outside. I had a bad back too, so I did walking meditation. And I was always doing it outside because I couldn't be in the meditation hall. And as I was doing my walking meditation, what finally came up was, I am not any different from anyone else. I am not separate from other beings. This is just a condition of my training. And everybody has their own difficulties. And that was like a breakthrough for me, because then I became more normal training with this disability. And so it makes me think now, while I'm looking back at this, that thinking we're separate and different is just a state of mind. That we're all in the same boat. We all have our difficulties, whether we have a serious illness or a serious physical disability. And I'm also going to talk about what we consider serious suffering, because I think that's part of it as well. And we're all training the best we can with these things. We're not that different from each other. And I have to say, when someone says to me, you know, well, my training is so different and I see things so differently, I sometimes say, well, you know, I see things in those ways too. And you're not that different. We're not that different. For me, something becomes a disability when I get so focused on it and lose my sympathy for other beings, because I think that's what happens. It seems to be a shutting down of what is good to do. My problem becomes all that matters. It's not only a focus on me and my problems, but we also tend to make mistakes in our training, our judgments, because we're so focused on. I remember one time when my back got really bad, and I was so intent on getting my back better, then I made some mistakes, and I didn't even know it. So we need to be aware of that. And I'm not just talking about older people as well. I found it really interesting when I, this is just an aside, but I went to see this doctor who's young about my foot. And I said, well, you know, will it heal as well since I'm 67 and I have osteoporosis? And he said, well, how did he put it? I think I wrote it down here. When we're getting older. He put it in a really nice way. When we're getting older, he did say, it, this is what we're focusing on. This type of surgery is for people who are getting older. So, but it was kind of a sweet way of putting it, not to say when you're old. So, anyway, he had a good bedside manner. But at any rate, this can happen when we're young. You know, people have disabilities, people get sick. And I was the infirmarian for a long time here. And when people would get colds, it would bring up the whole thing of illness and death. And people would become very focused on themselves. Not everybody, but this was a tendency. And it's not only physical disabilities and illness, it's also mental and spiritual pain that can also cut us off. Again, myself as an example, when I first came here, I have to admit, I was really suffering. I was desperate, and I was really, really suffering. And I couldn't see anything beyond that. I seriously couldn't. I didn't care about anyone else, really. Although if it came down to it, maybe I would have. But when I look back, and maybe I'm being unkind to myself, but when I look back, it was just this focus on me and my suffering and how can I deal with this. And when I heard that Buddhism was a religion of compassion, I was thinking, well, why isn't everybody being compassionate to me then? Never occurred to me that I could be compassionate to them, that was the point. But when our suffering is great, we can become completely focused on ourselves and our difficulties. And I think this is fairly normal. It's fairly normal. But we can train with this and we can change. The teaching I received when I first came here and became a monk was that in all things that we do, we should think of self and other and not just ourselves. When we put our shoes straight, we're putting them straight so that people don't trip over them. So in everything we do, we think of others. And that was a way of trying to help us break through this selfishness of not just thinking of ourselves. And I think most of us start out this way. We're very focused on ourselves. But I can say as the suffering eases up, we can see our interconnectedness with all beings and can open to the natural kindness and compassion that is our true nature. Oh, I was going to say, it seems ironic that when we are suffering, either physically or mentally, that... I'm going to read this. We focus on our minds, we focus on ourselves in order to relieve the suffering, and that's what we think will relieve it. But in actual fact, it's when we let go of the self that we find the cessation of suffering. We are taught that just trust in the path. Trust that this teaching works, that if we don't focus so much on our suffering, but just allow it to come and go as it arises naturally, and do our training and be kind to others, this is what will relieve our suffering. But it's hard to believe when we're suffering deeply, or when we're really scared because we're ill, or we have a disability that maybe won't go away. I find that I can train pretty easily with this foot when I think I'm going to have surgery, which I hope will work. But if someone were to tell me, you're going to have to live with this the rest of your life, I don't know how easily it would be to accept that, that I couldn't walk a lot for the rest of my life. I think that would be harder, but I know from my many years of training that I would have to train with it, because what else is there to do? And there also is something more important. There's something more important. When I was a young monk, and I think people knew I was suffering deeply spiritually. I mean, I think it was pretty obvious. And I remember a monk telling me, focusing on your suffering is not what will help you. What will help you is helping other beings and being kind to other beings. And yet at that time, I couldn't do it. I felt like, I am so miserable, I don't want other people to be happy. I don't want to help other beings. That might help them to be happier, and I'm really miserable. And that was my attitude anyway. However, recently a monk reminded me, when I was talking to her about some difficulties that were arising, don't focus on them. Be kind to other people. And then it was yes, I know this is. This is what I want to do. This is what's important. Even after we've been training for many years, it's really helpful to have things pointed out to us because we forget. And being generous and kind to others is the true training of the heart. And when we do the true training of the heart, our suffering naturally decreases. Oh, here's another thing. We can also, when we have a disability or illness or a lot of suffering, we can actually get into enjoying the kind of attention we get or the help we get in dealing with it. The self can kick in with, as Rev. Master Jiya would say, with a vengeance. And I have to say that this has happened with my foot. Monks don't tend to let you indulge yourself. But lay people sometimes, out of their great kindness, do. And and so a number of lay people asked me about my foot. And I, with great joy, although I may not have been aware of it, I enjoyed, talking about my foot and all the details of it. And they really seemed to want to know about it. And I realize this now, that's what I was doing. And I was getting into really enjoying thinking about my foot. And in fact, I started planning my whole recovery period. That was my main focus for the last, several weeks, was preparing my room for when I'd have 6 weeks of non-weight bearing, learning how to use crutches and a knee walker and strengthening exercises and all kinds of things. And I just kept thinking about my foot and how I could arrange things. And I took great joy in, sorting out my room and all that. It was kind of fun. And I finally realized that I was too focused on my foot. I was not concerned about other people. It was just a me focus. And my compassion and kindness had kind of disappeared because it was me. Me, me, me. And it's very interesting what happened because, while Reverend Vivian and Reverend Helen were away, I became the prior. And when our monks left for England, I became the person who was most senior here and the one to make the final decisions on things. And suddenly my foot became totally out of my focus. I didn't think about my foot at all because I realized what was most important. And it was being still and doing what was best for the monastery. This was a big responsibility, and there haven't been any problems, really, because we have a number of monks who've been training for a long time in a wonderful lay sangha, and it's just like everything's going smoothly as far as I can tell. But so it's not like I'm doing a whole lot, but the responsibility, I feel the responsibility. And being the prior, you are, as you know, you're incredibly busy. And I hadn't been this busy for a long time. So my foot really went into the background. And I realized this was healthier. And I felt a lot better caring about others and caring about the monastery and not focused on my foot. Opening my heart to what was truly important became what was important to me. Again, and of course that's what I always, you know, what I always come back to, but, you know, you have these little side detours where you get focused on something else, and you lose that. You lose that. But I find that, and this is true for everyone, there was always something helping us. And no matter how far off I get, something gets me back. Sometimes it's the other monks who are fed up with me. And sometimes it's just something from within, you know, realizes it. And I'm just hoping now that Reverend Vivian is back that I don't sink back into my foot. So so I have to be really aware of this and be very careful and not do that. And I think for me, in some ways, focusing on me is an escape from being with whatever is going on right now. If, you know, things are kind of difficult, stuff is coming up that's difficult, oh, I'll arrange my room for my foot, you know. And I also want to say it's important not to go in the opposite direction as well. Because we can be negligent of our body and our emotions and our health. We have to look after ourselves, but we have to look after ourselves. We can't ignore illness and disabilities. We have to take care of ourselves and be kind to ourselves. But there's a way of doing it in which we are not carried away by it, in which we don't lose sight of our training. And sometimes it can take a while. And that's okay, because with any luck, we eventually come back. Now I'd like to, I haven't talked that much about spiritual and mental suffering, but for those of you who don't have physical, well, it could be for both, but I think most of us at times experience this mental and spiritual suffering. And we don't ignore it, but we don't get so focused on it that we lose our natural kindness. And I think what it means in the case of illness and in the case of spiritual suffering is it's a doorway to opening up to the real truth of our lives and opening up to something, to what's truly important. But it can be scary. You know, I might have mentioned this already. It can open us to our own vulnerability, our own impermanence, you know, the fear of isolation, all these many things. But we have our meditation to help us. And our meditation will help us get through any of these if we're willing to do so. A few years ago, my mother died, and I wasn't actually that I didn't want to say the word fond of her, but we weren't that close. And it wasn't really that hard on me, but it brought up some things. And then my cat died, who I was very close to, and we had a very strong connection. And she had a very painful death, which was really difficult. And then just before I was going out to the Hermitage for a couple weeks, I went to see a nurse practitioner, and she found some things which she thought could be serious. But I wasn't going to look into them until I came back. And it turned out to be nothing. But I was going to the Hermitage with these death kind of right, lurking right there in front of my face. And Reverend Master Mahon said to me, this is an opportunity for you to open to this, to open to what the door that has been opened for you. You know, soon it will be closed again. you know, when someone has, somebody close to us has died, or we have an illness, these things open to us, the deeper aspects of our lives. And then when we get better, or we're, you know, a distance from the person who's died, they close up again, and we try and have our little safety spot, our safe, secure place. Well, I'm not saying everybody does this, but I think it's a tendency. And I think with the suffering as well, when we can get away from it, we're more than happy to get away from it. You know, it's our tendency to try to cover up the suffering and not go into it. But the longing for the eternal, the longing for something deeper, spurs us on to face our difficulties. And of course, illness and death, you know, force us to do that. But I was reading this article by an African-American Buddhist monk who wrote a book. Her name is Zenju Earthlin Manuel, and she wrote a book called The Way of Tenderness. And this article is an adaptation from that book, and I hope she will forgive me for just taking parts of it and reading it, perhaps somewhat out of context. But I was quite inspired by this, and I thought it would be helpful to read. She, when she was growing up, she faced racial hatred, and you know, it was very painful for her, for people, when people hated her because they thought her body was ugly. And she grew up with this deep rage, and she was, I hope I'm not changing this in any way, but she had a lot of suffering from this. It had affected her deeply, and she was closed down for protection. And this is how we can become, if we've had serious abuse or difficulties in our life, we can become closed down and protective and angry. And but her teacher gave her the name of Zenju, which means complete tenderness. And she is talking about tenderness in a way of the tenderness being the tenderness that comes from our true nature. This is how she is referring to it. So I'm going to read parts of this. So how does someone who has experienced deep hatred from within as well as without become Zenju, complete tenderness, a liberated tenderness that is not a wound but complete liberation from the rage that hatred breeds? So now I'm going to skip to further along. She's talking about that she can't ignore who she is. She can't ignore that she's an African American, that she has suffered this hatred, and that she's a female. She can't ignore that. So she talks about that a lot. How could a path to spiritual liberation possibly unfold if we turn away from the realities that particular embodiments bring? To confront hatred with spirituality is to confront the way we view race, sexuality, gender, or whatever form of embodiment we are as living beings. To provide a meaningful path to spiritual liberation, spirituality must acknowledge the body and the denigration of certain types of bodies in the world. We cannot close our eyes to these phenomena if we really want to be awake and aware. Many people believe that spiritual paths should tend toward the invisible, the unseen. With this view, it is easy to mistake a favorable blindness, not seeing skin, color, gender, and so on, for seeing an invisible truth of life. We may even consider this blindness to be a higher state of being. But the wisdom in my bones says that we need this particular body, with its unique color, shape, and sex, for liberation to unfold. There is no experience of emptiness without interrelationship. We must look our embodiment in the face in order to attend to the challenge it presents. Only then will we come to engage each other with all of what we are, both the relative and the absolute, the physical and the formless. So what was just coming up for me in this is not to see our lives in a negative way, no matter what has happened to us. I don't know how to explain this, but if you've been abused, let's say, or you've had this thing with race or some other thing, homosexuality has been very difficult for people as well, especially in the South. There's a real negative negativity towards that. But not to see it as a disability, but to see it as the way towards liberation. The way of tenderness appears on its own, rising up as an experience void of hatred for oneself or others. It comes when the events of your life have rendered you silent and sat you in the corner, and there is nothing left to do but sit until the mental distress or confusion about who you are or who you are not passes. The way of tenderness may present itself when rage is so palpable that you are dizzy with it. It may come as a lion's roar. The way of tenderness comes even when failing to fight for our lives is what we fear the most. Complete tenderness arrives even if we have no desire to sink beneath the appearance of things, including our own identities and aspirations. The way of tenderness is an experiential, non-intellectual, heartfelt acknowledgement of all embodied difference. It is a flexibility of perception rather than a settling into belief. It brings affirmation of life rather than of suffering center stage. I thought that was important. It keeps alive the vow not to kill in a way that has nothing to do with being vegetarian or not. It is social action. It is a way to overcome what feels much stronger than us and what seems to pull us apart so that we are not well. It is an acknowledgement of the unfolding experience of life that is effortlessly ever-present in all living beings, and yet it does not deny the uniqueness or similarities of our embodiment. It simply arises along the path of life, if we allow it. The tenderness that arose in my life brought with it a liberated and full-hearted engagement with life. It was a transformation of pent-up anger, rage, and disappointment. Instead of sinking into pain and separation, I did a very scary thing. I allowed tenderness, a gentle opening, a softness of mind and body to surface. I followed that opening until the way of tenderness unearthed itself as a liberated path. It is a natural, organic, innate medicine or teaching within the body itself. I used to be afraid of being seen in this softness, afraid of being viewed as soft. How could I be tender in the liberated sense and also be strong and safe? How could I meet disrespect or disregard with tenderness? How could I trust it? When I contemplated being tender in this way, I realized that it did not equal quiescence. It did not mean that fiery emotions would disappear. It did not render it acceptable that anyone could hurt or abuse life. Tenderness does not erase the inequities we face in our relative and tangible world. I am not encouraging a spiritual bypass of the palpable feelings that we experience. The way of tenderness is an intangible elixir for the clogged arteries in the heart of our world. Complete tenderness is an experience of life that trusts the fluidity of our life energy and its extension into those around us. On the way of tenderness, we allow rage and anger to flow in and out again and again, instead of holding on to it as proof of being human. We can let go of stockpiling our rage for fear that our suffering might go unrecognized, or that we'll appear apathetic or naive. A liberated tenderness is a way of lessening and finally removing the potency of our tragic past as sentient beings. It is what will change that which leads us to annihilate the unacceptable differences between us. So, I had more to talk about, but I think it's hard to continue after that. So I think I'll leave it here and leave the rest unsaid. So thank you very much.